The Curl Test Suite. I'll be getting into some depth into what it is and what you can use it for and why it's so great and how you can all help to make it better. And hopefully you'll know why when we're done here. So what exactly is the Curl Test Suite? It's a set of tests that verify the correct operation of Curl. It basically takes the inputs from the test configuration, it runs the commands, and it generates outputs, and then it validates that those outputs are what are expected. That's essentially what it is in a nutshell. So if you find a bug in Curl, what you should really be doing is thinking about how did this bug get in there, why didn't we detect this bug in the past, and how can we make sure that this kind of bug does not come back and regress the operation of Curl. So it's a good idea, an excellent idea, and highly recommended that when you do find a bug and fix a bug, you add a test so that it doesn't come back. So the test suite also, since it runs everywhere, just about everywhere the Curl runs, it means you can get, you can test that your change is actually valid in more than just your test system. I'll be talking a little bit about the Curl auto build system later on. Many people run these the test suites on a regular basis, like daily, if not more often, and it'll report tests that fail. So you can say, "Oh, hey, the Solaris 10 has a test that fails on IDN. What's going on there? And why did my IDN change break Solaris, for example?" So what actually gets tested in Curl? So this is a tag cloud of some of the test configurations that we have. So each test gets some keywords to describe what the tests can do. And you can filter those keywords and use them. They're also self-documentation. So here's about the top 100. So you can see what the is getting tested more than other things. What do you know? HTTP has a lot of tests. Isn't that good? And then you can see some pretty less used features there. FTP IPv6, not too many tests for that one. But you can see that the test suite is actually fairly comprehensive and a lot of stuff is tested there. There are some things that are missing, but all in all, it's doing a pretty good job, I think. So this graph here is very similar to the one Daniel showed earlier for the main Curl code. This is actually a graph showing the number of tests and the lines of code just in the test suite itself. So you can see here, the first tests were added in Curl version 7.3, I guess it is, and going on up from there. So the yellow line is the lines of code, and the blue one is the number of tests. And you can see that there's actually a pretty very close correlation actually between the two. The code there, lines of code, is just the Perl and the C code that comprise the test suite. There's no actual real live Curl code in there. So if you actually and then the test configs themselves that describe the tests are not included there. If you wanted to add those, that would be another 72,000 lines of test code. And that's actually about 69 lines of code per test. So I'll go through some of the highlights over here. So in version 6.5, that's the very first version that's tagged in Git. At version 7.5, the test suite was created for the first time. And you can actually see it's the very first test suite actually had 47 tests, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
Well done. Version 7.8, which is in the year 2001, the test suite format changed. So before there was a number of different files per test, this consolidated them into a single file per test. And that's essentially what we have today. And from there, for some reason, I couldn't figure out from the Git history, we went from 67 tests down to 18. I don't know why, but later on that year,
because it took a while to convert to the new format.
Could be, but the old ones were all taken out and deleted, and then maybe that's it, and they just slowly added back
right,
and had them on your local hard disk.
Maybe I did that, and maybe I sort of it took time to do, build them together and add them again. I don't remember. Actually.
Maybe that's it. But it didn't take long, a few months, and then we're back up to 76 tests. So that was a very short gap. So about the year 2007, that's around the version 7.16 time frame. We standardized on the 8-week release cycle, so you can see the graph becomes a little bit more regular at that point. Version 7.16.1, the test suite switched to a very XML-like format, not quite XML, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. Version 20.0 in 2010, you can see there's a 30% jump in the lines of code in the one release. What version was that? 30%, yeah, version 7.20. So I'll leave this jump right over here. That actually, I looked into it, and that is nothing super special. There's some internal refactoring, and there's RTSP support. Just a couple of things that added a whole bunch of lines of code. 2011, version 7.21.4, the unit test framework was added. Version 7.27.0, a year later, so there's another jump there. And that is, there were actually 81 tests added in that release, and that was a whole mishmash of things. A lot more SSH tests, FTP, HTTP, libcurl tests, a whole bunch. More Gopher tests were added in that release too, so there was a good reason that line went up. And version 7.46.0, we broke the 1,000 test barrier. Yay. And version 7.49.0, there's another 1,000 line of code jump. And that was primarily for the man page scanner. That was the biggest chunk that was added there.
But it could also be mentioned that you're counting test cases by test file test files really, and some of those tests are really more than just one test. Especially the unit tests. I mean, they sum them to hundreds of tests. So
that's a good point. Yeah,
it's a bit artificial what the test number is.
Yeah, that's a good point. Right. And then there's all the tests that just to test one tiny little thing, and then the other test is almost identical, but one tiny little thing. But you're right. And then finally, at the end of my analysis in 2016, version 7.52.1, we ended up with 1,050 tests, and that's pretty close to where we are today. So that's a lot of tests, but how effective are they actually? So if we have to all of a sudden suddenly jump up and run out there, I'm sure he'll let us know. But in the meantime, I'll continue. Version 7.16.3 in the year 2007, I did a code coverage analysis of libcurl, posted to the mailing list at the time. And there, I was running in my test configuration 355 out of the 373 tests that were available. And I got the figures of 84% functional coverage, which means that 84% of the functions within libcurl and curl were actually covered by test suites. They were actually called by the test suites, which is actually pretty decent. A lot of commercial companies aim for like an 80% coverage to be reasonably sure of that you're testing those things. 71% line coverage, so that's decent as well. And 67% block coverage. The block would be things like within an if block or within a for loop, this sort of thing. So that's not too bad. This particular configuration I was using was missing Kerberos and a couple of other things, so it wasn't testing absolutely everything, but still, it's pretty reasonable. I ran a couple of manual tests for some untested protocols like Telnet, Dict, and LDAP, and that increased the line coverage by about 3%, so which isn't a whole lot. So adding more test servers for these protocols would certainly be a good idea, but as far as line coverage goes, it wouldn't make a big, big difference. So the latest release, at the time I did this, I repeated this test, And the figure's actually very similar. Better functional coverage, 87% now. Line coverage is better at 73%, and 3% more block coverage as well. So this configuration, I was missing a few more protocols, those ones listed there. And also, because the unit tests are linked into libcurl differently, they use a static version of the library, those are not covered. So the actual coverage is better than that. So that's not too bad. So we're up over 105,000 lines of code in the curl library in the source right now, versus only 61,000 back in the other previous release that I showed you. So with 170% increase in number of tests over that time, coverage has certainly kept up and increased.
That's better than I expected, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, 1,050 tests, that's not too bad. So from the start of Git to the end, you can see how much change has actually happened in the Git repository. Over 21,000 commits, 3,500 bug fixes, over 700 named changes that are listed in the README file, 74 documented platforms that curl runs on, and 1,050 tests. So that's a lot of churn, and the curl test suite is one of the reasons why the quality of the curl implementation is very high, and why it's used absolutely everywhere, because people can rely on it, it does work, and people can have confidence that it's going to stay that way. So I'll talk a little bit about the test cases themselves. So as I mentioned, nowadays the test configuration is found in a single file. It's in very similar to an XML format. So it's almost but not quite XML. There's a couple of differences. The character entities are not supported. That's the big one. The greater than less than brackets are not escaped. Carriage return line feed are not significant. And those are most of the big differences. So it's not quite XML, but still the fact that it's very similar to XML means you can use XML analysis tools on a lot of the tests, not all of them, unfortunately. So things like XML lint and XML starlets, you can query the tests, extract keywords from them, things like that. So it would be nice if we could bridge that gap, make it true XML, but there's some issues with that. The test would become a lot less readable because we're using tags all over the place. We're using ampersands and other special characters that would have to be escaped. Carriage return line feeds would have to use character entities. Some tests use embedded null characters. I'm not convinced that it would be an overall improvement doing that. But it would make a lot more easier access to the metadata within the tests. So the XML lint I ran on as many as I could, and I've actually found issues with with some of the tests missing tags, missing closing tags and the like. And there's a couple of tests I recall that were actually ended up being essentially no ops because there were tags missing. So I was able to fix those.
I'd like to add some tests for actually that. Scan the tests more regularly.
All right. So to be reliable, we'd have to make our own custom scanner, but that's relatively simple to do.
Yeah, it's very simple. Because program. You found some obvious mistakes like that, we're going to make them again.
Yeah, that's true. I run them manually once in a while, but you're right. It's not the best situation. So in a few tests, there's actually a binary that is linked in with libcurl actually runs the tests. That's done when you can't do the test from the command or from the curl command line. Normally, we try to do that because it's quicker and less code churn and less compile time. But it's not always possible. Some tests, also like the man page scanner I mentioned, are written as a curl script that can do anything you want. That one will go through the man pages and just look for formatting problems and the like. So I'll talk about the test file format a little bit. Start to get into some of the details. So this is what a typical test case looks like. XML-like tags. The info, the test case is the outer tag. The whole test will fit between the test case and the slash test case tags. The info section contains, at the moment, only keywords. So the ones you saw in the tag cloud, they really should contain the test descriptions as well, but for historical reasons, they don't. The reply section contains instructions to the particular test server that we're running about what sort of response we want to see. For an HTTP test that we want to return, like a 404 or something, then that would go in there. So header and data lines can be in there. The client section it describes what the client actually does, what the curl command line or the libcurl linked binary will do, command line options and the like. It holds which test servers will actually be running at the time. If it's an HTTP test, we have to have an HTTP server running that will respond to that test case. The name of the test as well, that's something else that's really in the info section. And there's also the possibility to have a script run that checks preconditions for the test. So if your test only works for Windows, for example, or only works for the standard localhost IP addresses, that you can put a little precondition in there. And if it's not satisfied, the test is simply skipped. So you can do all kinds of different platform and very specific tests for that. Without worrying that they're going to fail in places that don't have that feature. And then finally, there's the verify section. So once a test is complete, then you have to figure out if it succeeded or not. So this contains the contents that you expect to see on standard output, the protocol headers that you expect to see being sent, regular expressions or Perl statements that can modify the output somewhat. For example, the user agent string has a version number in it sometimes, so you don't want your test to fail because you upgraded curl to the next version, so you can strip that out, this sort of thing. So, and a lot of these different sections allow a certain amount of string replacement for things like the test port numbers and IP addresses. So when you run a test against the test server, you don't know what port it's running on necessarily, so the string substitution can replace the port number with what's actually being configured for your test. So here's an example of a test. This is test number one. You can see all the different pieces in there. The comment in there, the first test at the beginning, I should say comment in quotes because it's simply text within this XML document. It's simply ignored by everything. No test case, anything looks for text between the test case and the info sections. So it's simply ignored. The hash symbol doesn't do anything. There's also some support for the XML style comments as well, in certain cases anyways. So a couple tests have that to make them more XML-like. So in this case, an HTTP test, the data section shows what you want the HTTP server to return, simple 200 with a little bit of data in there. The client section here describes the fact that you need an HTTP server. The test name gets displayed when you run it. The command itself is simply, this is appended to the curl command line. You're simply getting this particular URL. You can see the substitution there, host IP, and HTTP port number are substituted with what the test server is actually running at the time. And when the test is done, it's the output that you get is compared with that. The user agent line is stripped, as I mentioned, and then you expect the curl to have sent these particular headers in that order. And if everything checks out...
The host IP seems wrong, right?
Host IP?
In the
protocol. Yeah, that's a good point, actually. That should probably be replaced. Make a note of it. Open up something on GitHub issue there. So how do you actually run these tests? Pretty simple. Once you have a curl build, you just run make test, and you're done. It'll run the test suite with all the default options. It auto-detects most features that you have. A couple it doesn't, but it should generally just work. At the end, if you get a return status of zero, your tests succeeded, all 1,050 or however many it was able to run. You can also run them manually by going into the test directory and just running the run test script. There's options available to configure it somewhat. For example, if you're just testing a particular test case, you don't want to run all 1,000 tests, you can just specify the number that you're testing there. The dash V option will produce more verbose output. It includes the command lines that the test suite is actually running. In the case of torture tests, it displays a time. The dash T there turns on the torture test, which could be worth a whole talk on its itself.
That's the treasure trove of fun.
For sure. But what essentially it does is it runs each test multiple times, up to 1,000 or 2,000 times, as I've seen it do. But what it does is it counts the number of memory allocations done within curl during that test run. And it'll run the test multiple times, and each time it will cause a memory allocation, a malloc, to fail. So it returns zero, no more memory left. And then it watches to see if what happens. Does it crash? Does it do something really weird? Hopefully not. Hopefully that out-of-memory condition will be caught, and there won't be any null-pointed dereferences or anything. And if the first memory allocation failure succeeds, then it runs the whole test again, and this time it lets the first one succeed, and then it fails the second one, and so forth and so on. Torture tests take a long time to run. I have auto build running once a week. I run about 80% of the torture tests, and it takes all night to run. The next day I run another 10 tests or something. The long ones, that takes another night to run. And there's a few that I just don't bother running.
I think there's some problems too. I think the test suite isn't really handling those. Some of those failures cause some stupid hangs, so it will take longer than they have to.
Right, that's true.
When some critical ones sort of just fail.
And some of them also involve timeouts.
Right,
protocol level timeouts, so some of them just take forever. But hey, at least they don't crash in the ones I managed to get going. Okay, so on the next command line there, you see the dash N. This will turn off the use of valgrind. It'll automatically use valgrind if it's available. Dash K, everybody here knows what dash K does after the last talk. This dash K is different. This one keeps the log files around after a test is run. So normally, succeeded tests have all the log files deleted, but sometimes you need it for debugging. So the final line there is another way to run the test suite that is sometimes more convenient for an out of tree build. The options there, dash A, will continue running a test will continue running subsequent tests even if a test fails. Normally it would just stop so you can see the results. The dash P will print the log file contents to the screen after a failed test, so you don't need to do it manually. Dash N is for valgrind. Then you can see the keywords. Actually, the previous one had some keywords as well. So the HTTP put and not HTTPS. This will run every test that has HTTP put as a keyword. So if the tests all have the right metadata, this will test all the tests that actually do a put, except for the ones that use HTTPS. So this can be really handy to get some confidence that some change to the HTTP put for handling, for example, is working everywhere without having to run all 1,000 tests, including the relevant ones every time. The exclamation mark, as you probably guessed, means a not, so it will run tests that do not have that keyword. The not flaky there is actually a good one for package maintainers and the like. There's a few tests that just aren't quite right. They're timing dependent. There's race conditions that don't really affect the operation of curl, but they cause a test to fail. You don't really want your package release to fail because of a known issue with a flaky test. So you can just add the not flaky, and those tests will simply be skipped. So what is the flow of running an actual test? So this is what the run test PL script actually does. So first it selects a test number to actually run, depending on keywords or if you give the number itself. Then it reads the test configuration from this XML-like file. It'll see what servers it needs, and it'll start those running. It will write this section called server command into a file. Some servers will use that to customize what they're actually doing. Then it'll write file sections into actual files on the file system. So for uploading files, for example, you can write a little file and put it or whatever. It'll run the pre-check section to make sure that any preconditions are satisfied. It'll run the command or the tool, so whether the command line tool or some custom library or Perl script. And then there's a post-check section that does an operation that may be necessary after the test is run. And then finally it'll do the verification, make sure it's doing what it's expected to. So the server test flow would be what, for example, the test HTTP server would be doing when it gets started. So it'll receive the connection from curl on port 80, it's not actually port 80, it's the higher port. Then it reads the server command section from the file. It's a known file name. And this can configure the server for certain operations that it needs before it gets any other indication of what test is actually running. Normally, the test number that you're running is embedded within the request that the curl makes. For example, if you're running test one, you saw that earlier. If you looked at the URL, you would see that it actually ended in /1. And the test server actually uses that number to decide what test is running, and then it will read that test configuration file. There's certain tests that will, like failure tests and the like, that need to configure the server before that even happens. For example, if the server wants to terminate the connection early before it even gets that protocol. Or in the case of FTP, for example, there's FTP commands that you might want to return before it even gets the file name to download. So then the test server will receive the request from curl over the socket. And then... Yes.
The server has spawned per test or for the whole test?
In most cases, the server is spawned once the first time the test starts, and then it stays running until the end of the test suite. There is possibility to forcefully kill the server afterwards, but I don't think we're actually using that feature anymore.
No, I think it used to do it because some of our tests turned the server really stupid, so sort of, we didn't really solve this, so we just killed the server, started over. But I think, I'm not sure we have that case left anymore, but we still have that ability to tell the tests to kill the server afterwards, because the server, I mean, this is just a test, the server is actually very stupid and really simple. Like, it doesn't do anything clever, it just sends whatever is written.
Because the logic is in the server command.
Exactly, so the server itself, it doesn't really speak HTTP, it just sort of, something comes in, sends something out, it doesn't know anything. Just does what it says on server.
Do you think don't like the real server?
Yeah, but we don't need a real server. I think that is the point. Because if we want to have this ability to send really crap back, or, I mean, we don't understand anything, so here's crap back. And the real server would be much harder to make send crap. So this is actually more made like we can send whatever.
Yeah, one person said crap to myself.
So finally, once the server has configured itself, then it responds as it's been requested to. So there's a couple of protocols that actually have back and forth handshakes. For example, some authentication protocols need a couple of back and forths before you can actually do the request. So the reply section that the server uses to know what data to send back can have a numbered subsection. And so you can have several of these in there. And in the case of authentication, the server is smart enough to know that authentication is happening and will actually cycle through these reply sections in turn. So you can have the different parts of the handshake in there. So there, in that case, the test number that the server sends, or the server receives, contains that embedded in the last four digits. So types of tests. I talked about this a little bit briefly. Normal tests just use the curl command line to somehow exercise curl, sometimes with the server, sometimes without. A lib test is a piece of C code that's linked to the libcurl to give access to tests that can't be done for the command line, such as for the multi-interface or some libcurl options that just aren't exposed by the command line tool. Then there's a unit test, which is also C code, but it's statically linked to a static version of libcurl, so that it has access to all the internal identifiers. And then finally, there's a simple Perl script like the man page one. So these tests can all be customized using the command line parameters in the config file. So I'll show a couple of sample tests. So this is test 1530. See this now. So this is an example of a kind of libcurl test that can't be done from the command line. It uses the OpenSocket function. So you have to have a C code to actually drive it. There's the OpenSocket call. The test suite itself is simply this test section, and you can do basically whatever you want in there. You can see a very normal curl invocation here, libcurl, I should say. Init, set the OpenSocket function, you perform it, and let's see, at the end, so it returns the return code from that. Now, hopefully this will actually have a verify section. Yes. It verifies that the error code returned by curl, by that program is 7. And this is because the OpenSocket function here deliberately returns an error code, curl socket bad. And this is verifying that this error gets converted into the right return code and the application gets notified of it. This is an example of.
In the previous test, was those two files are all that we took for the test, or were there any other mentioning the other configuration files in this test?
No, it's just these two files, and the make file, of course. Okay. So this is the configuration file that configures it. You can see it's the tool is called lib1530 instead of command line, and this is a lib1530 source code. The make file will build a binary called lib1530, and that's what's actually invoked.
And who invokes this number? You go to all the files and then try to...
Yes. So in that test data directory is where this test file lives. And curl just, the test suite scans through each file and matching either on the number or on the keyword to figure out which one you want to run. So this is another example of a lib test. In this particular case, you can see there's a couple of options here. Compile time options, if curl does conversions, else that. There's TPF, actually that's, that's not the best example of it. The point I wanted to make was that certain libcurl binaries are sometimes used in very similar tests with a slightly different return code, a slightly different value. So you'll see some tests actually have an if-def based on the test number. So you have to actually build different binaries for the to do the different tests. As a general rule, it's better to do that sort of configuration at runtime, so you don't need to build an extra binary for each test. You can just pass in a command line parameter, and then the test can configure itself at runtime. So here's an example of a unit test. So there's these magic unit setup and unit stop section where you can do configuration and tear down of your test. And then there's this unit test start macro instead of a function. And within this, you can do just about what you want. In this case, we use testing the hash add function here, hash add, hash clean, and here's an abort. If there's an error in the function, then it will return an error code there, and the test has failed. This is a Perl test. This is one of the man page ones, and here you can see the command, instead of calling curl, calls this nrof scan with a bunch of options, and that does whatever it does and operates just like any other test.
So basically this could be used to just run your own test, okay, for instance you have some logic separated already and done. I just want to run it. I could plug it via this Perl type of test.
Yeah, you could do that. So the assumption is that the source code is within this source dir, so if you're adding this like in a custom internal build of curl, then just add that into the source directory and it'll run it just like any other one. Here's an example of a test using pre-check. So there's the pre-check section here. Here it is. So in this particular case, it's a POP3 test testing OAuth. And you can see here, in the verification section, there's this big opaque base64 block. This actually embeds the IP address into that block. That's part of how this OAuth bearer token is created. So if you were to run this test server on other than the default IP address and port, then the test would fail. Not because the curl is failing, just because the test preconditions are wrong. So here there's a pre-check that verifies that the host IP address and the port number are as expected, since they're embedded in this base64 block. And if it's not, the test is simply skipped.
Can I have a question?
Yeah.
Does the base64 block need to be fixed, or can we compute it at runtime? Are there some tests that have this variable at runtime?
There's no facility to actually compute this sort of thing at runtime. It could be added to the test suite, but most people do not just use the standard port numbers, so it doesn't really seem like it would be that useful in the general case to have this sort of thing, because you'd have to add this. This is very OAuth specific. There's NTLM test, I think, that works similarly. So I think in the general case, probably wouldn't be useful.
I think we tend to do the other way, that we sort of we fake the other end to stay fixed. Like we have a way to fake host name and we have fake random and stuff like that, so we can do debug builds.
But it means that you need some instrumented library. This is usually not possible in the production version of the library.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, that's the downside. Yeah, you can only do those tests with a debug version of curl. So yes, that's true.
So this is a diagram of the test suite process architecture. So this would be the processes that would be running partway through a test run. So you can see up top there's the run test script. The dashed lines show the control flow. So it's starting the curl that's actually running the test. But before that, it starts these different servers. And you can see the data flow is actually directly between curl. In this particular case, it's an HTTP test, so directly between those two. You can also see how some of the tests are structured. For example, HTTPS tests are run through this other Perl script called Perl or C, I don't remember now. secure server, which runs, actually spawns S-Tunnel. And it opens up this port 8991 on S-Tunnel. And with the curl, if we're running that test, you'd see the dark line going straight from here to port 8991. S-Tunnel simply goes back into the regular HTTP server test. Most tests are, our test servers, I should say, are embedded within the curl source code tree, so they're built and are self-contained. There's a couple of servers that are not, and they're the green ones in this particular diagram. So S-Tunnel is not, but it's pretty commonly available, so we didn't want to write our own HTTP wrapper, so we just use that. SSHD is another example, so we use the OpenSSH server to terminate the SSH tests. And there are, I think those are the main ones. There's a couple others. For the TLS SRP tests, we use the GNU TLS server, NGHTTP2 for HTTP2 tests. There's also this sockfilt, which is worth a mention. So for the Perl test servers, the sockfilt is used. Originally, it was created to make the test suite a little bit more portable to older Perl versions. It may not be actually technically required for that anymore because our Perl requirements have increased in the last 15 years. But it basically abstracts some of the low-level network operations so that the Perl scripts have slightly less to do. I mentioned also that the port numbers can sometimes change. So these are the default port numbers you can see up here. Of course, if you use the default numbers, you can only run one test suite at once on a single machine. But if you want to run two different test suites and two different curl builds, you can actually pass in a -B option, and that will set a different base port number range. And then you can actually run two simultaneous test suites out of different source trees on the same server at the same time.
And we use a lot of port numbers because we have a lot of test servers. So it's like 16 ports or 20 ports or something.
I think this, I'm assuming this, I think 8990 is the first one that was added, which is slightly less than 9,000. So back then, yeah, I guess no one figured that we'd ever need more than 10 port numbers, so that was fine. So there's a couple more tricks in the test suite that can be useful. There's support for running GDB on a test failure, which can be really useful to automatically go right to the test line that is failing or crashing, as the case may be. There's a built-in support for detecting memory leaks. That's if you enable the enable debug option. The torture test, as I mentioned before. There's automatic val grind support if it's available. The keyword filters I talked about as well, which can be very useful when testing certain features. You can also specify test ranges, so if you want to run every test from 500 to 599, which is where most of the libcurl tests are, then you can do that. And you can also permanently disable tests. There's this magic file called disabled, and if there's some test that's not working right, or you know that it's never going to work because of a bug in curl or something, you don't want all the auto builds to fail, you can just add it to disabled. Unfortunately, there's a lot of tests and disabled. It's supposed to be a short-term measure. You add it there, and then you fix the underlying problem, then you undisable it. But
there, and then you move on.
Yeah, no one ever runs it. No one realizes it's failing. So
look,
okay.
No test failures.
Right.
So yeah, it struck me. I came to think of one more trick. I don't even know if you know about it. It's the -E option for run tests.
I don't recognize that one.
If you run that with a debug-enabled curl, it'll use the event-based curl multi or easy perform, sort of emulating the easy perform function by using the event-based API, the socket action API.
Very cool. I was not aware of that one.
That's actually it's really handy because we don't have any we don't typically have any test cases for the event-based API. So that's the way.
The cloud doesn't use the event-based, it uses the old multi.
Yeah, Curl uses the regular multi-perform one internally, sort of. Or the easy perform, which is a wrapper just for the multi-perform. But that's not the event-based one. But if you run tests with dash E, it uses the emulated one that uses the event-based API. So it's supposed to then work identically. So it's not supposed to be different. But it's a good way to just make sure that the event-based API works the same way.
Sounds like another Aru build off that next week.
Yeah, exactly. Ideally, we would run all tests with and without dash E, really. But, you know, it takes a long time. So. And it's only for debugging this. So.
Ah, right, right.
Because I also sort of that emulation of the socket event, the event triggered things. I have a sort of weird. I mean, it's not using an event based library. It's just using the API sort of on pod wrapper.
Okay. Oh, a little glitch there. So there's a few things that could be improved on the test suite. It's great, but of course there's always room for improvement. One of them is increasing the speed. So right now it takes about 8 minutes to run 1,023 tests on my 2.8 gigahertz machine. It would be interesting to see a graph of time to run the test suite over the various releases, but it's not getting any faster because we're adding so many tests. So there's one way I was thinking about improving this is to run various tests in parallel. So you could run like an HTTP test and an FTP test at the same time because there's no overlap between the servers. So that would improve things, but the problem is exactly 50% of the tests require HTTP. So running anything in parallel with that means that you'll never get more than 50% or 50% reduction in time, which of course is nothing to brag about, but the infrastructure to do that would be a little bit invasive. I've thought of a few ways of doing it, but for a 50% increase, I don't know. But if anyone else has any great ideas, I'd love to hear. It would be useful to have a generic test server as well. So there's some untested protocols right now. There's LDAP, DICT, POP3S, IMFS, SMB, RTMP, and Telnet has no tests. I'm sure there's a few sad faces to learn about that. A generic test server I'm envisioning as being something that abstracts the very dumb test servers we have right now even further. So rather than having an HTTP server that just reads in lines of HTTP headers that just throws back at the curl when it's supposed to, this would be it would actually look at the data coming in and it would compute some sort of cryptographic hash on the data coming in, and when it sees the matching data to some hash it has, then it returns the value that is pre-configured. So this would be almost completely generic. You could return something based on anything you get in. So you could test a lot of these protocols just by doing that. It might be a bit tricky to actually set up the test suite this way, calculating these hashes and the like, but it would allow testing some of these fairly simple protocols that just don't have any tests right now because no one's written an entire SMB server to test against.
And again, there are SMB servers, but plugging in a real SMB server is not what we want. That's really horrible. So we want to have a stupid SMB server.
Yes.
Sometimes the protocols themselves change. For instance, if you have this kind of server, real server of HTTP, using, for instance, Python request library, any kind of real server,
yeah.
When the protocol changes and the real life problem arises, not immediately.
Right.
Like if you just fake the data, it won't matter.
So, talked about some of these untested protocols already. We should really get rid of those disabled tests. Fix the underlying problem, fix the test, figure out what's going on, and maybe the test is simply not really valid and just get rid of it. But anyone who wants something to start hacking curl on, you can start with that. There's a couple of auto tools tests, which auto tools is it gives you a different way to create a set of test suites. There's just a very, very few of those currently in, available and enabled. We should really move those into the main test suite so that they run along with all the other ones. Switching to true XML would be useful, but as I talked earlier on that topic, it would make the tests a lot harder to read, and I don't know. I'm not convinced yet. Something else we could do is create some Docker images to make running the test suites earlier. I've been experimenting with that a little bit lately and running on some very strange setups and discovering a couple of assumptions that are invalid and linking and the like. The Docker, of course, makes it very easy for anybody to run tests on wacky architectures, but still only Linux. So it really limits the reach of and a variety of different environments. And once someone runs this Docker image and runs it how to build, then no one else really needs to do it. So it's limited use, but still, I found some problems already this way. It would also be really useful to have better tracking of test failures in the auto builds page. So I haven't talked to Worley about that, but people who run these tests regularly upload the results to the curl server, and they're displayed on the auto builds page regularly, so you can see whose test suites are actually failing, and you get all the logs there as well. But these all end up in a big black box, and unless you actually go to this page and look at it, it's limited usefulness. It would be really useful to be able to track test failures to specific commits or specific users and email them or send an alert or something. So that was my idea for what we could be doing in the future. And that's the end of my presentation. So any questions?
Just another remark. We do run the test suite on pull request with Travis on GitHub.
Oh, that's right, too, yeah.
So we at least have some sort of measure to make sure that pull request and that we don't merge code that too blatantly write the test suite.
Mm-hmm. So does that run the flaky test as well? Like the so-called flaky test with the flaky
keyword? Yeah, it
runs everything.
It doesn't make a test. So.
Okay.
When it fails, it sucks.
Yes.
Yeah. It might be worthwhile adding this no flaky option there then, because otherwise we could get some.
Yeah, we should do that. Yeah. Probably. Or, yeah.
Yes.
So if you already have GitHub integration, we could add Solaris build support, because our GitHub has GitHub integration.
Mm.
Just what needs to be configured is the specific hooks in GitHub, and the token to get the status tag. Maybe we
can
do this during the hacking session if you want.
That, that might be worthwhile, because I'm assuming Travis is Linux only. Oh, no, there's Windows supported as well, but we're not using it.
No, Linux and Mac.
Mac, okay. Okay, so yeah, Solaris would be useful too. Yes?
You mentioned that you have no tenant tests.
Sorry?
No tests for tenant protocols.
Right.
But why don't you simply tell that part of curl to HTTP requests and just reuse your HTTP request by putting the request in the input?
Yes,
true.
Sure.
Yeah.
Build.
Exactly as Alexander showed, we could actually do echo HTTP commands to it.
That might be useful. So some of the telnet negotiation, like terminal negotiation stuff, would not be tested, so it would be fairly basic stuff that we could do, but at least it would prove that Telnet wasn't totally broken, which is, at the moment, easily done.
Yeah, but I mean, Telnet has these options, you can negotiate stuff, and I mean, I guess nobody ever uses them. We don't even know if they work.
Okay, well, thank you very much.